The numbers right now, 55 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show from Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking in the first part of today's morning show about a book that just crossed my path and which I have been thoroughly enjoying, a book called Playing from the Rough, A Personal Journey Through America's 100 Greatest Golf Courses. I want to say at the outset, I am no fan of the game of golf. I have scarcely played it even once in my life, and I don't particularly follow the sport of golf either. But that does not mean that I didn't find this book incredibly interesting. It tells the story of a very intriguing personal odyssey undertaken by my morning show guest and the author of the book, Jimmy James, who not long after retiring, after a long career with Exxon, decided to embark on a journey over the course of a year that would take him to the 100 greatest golf courses in the country. And it proved to be a fascinating and entertaining and inspiring journey that also in some respects helped him see America in the 21st century and helped him understand his own past, which included a childhood in severe poverty. And the contrast between his life then and his life now and the kind of things and sights and sounds that he experienced, the people he met, is all woven together beautifully in this memoir. Again, titled Playing from the Rough, A Personal Journey Through America's 100 Greatest Golf Courses, published by Simon & Schuster. Jimmy James, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Great to be here and have the opportunity to talk about Playing from the Rough.
I really did enjoy this book. And again, I'm no golfer. I'm no particular fan of the game, but I'm a fan of great books, and that's what this is. It really, really is. Ahead of us talking about this year-long odyssey, sketch for our listeners, if you would, the sort of unlikely beginning of your life, the childhood that I described to our listeners, and the difference that was made in those difficult years by your beloved mother, Thelma James.
So I was born in the late Jim Crow era in East Texas, the piney woods of East Texas, to a mother who, at the time, had three kids. All of us born out of, I was the fourth, all of us born out of wedlock. My birth certificate has the two words on it that I think most people thought were the most important things about me back in 1959, colored and illegitimate. We lived in a shack, a wooden shack with a tin roof, no plumbing, no electricity. And it's sort of embarrassing to say now, but I used to wipe my butt with crumbled pages from a Sears and Roebuck catalog. We crumbled the pages to soften them. what we ate, we either raised, grew, or killed. But in the middle of all of that sort of challenge or darkness was my mother. She was our slither of light. She, like you, she never played golf. You maybe played once, but she never played at all. Probably didn't know much about the game of golf. But what she taught us that reminded me of golf is to play the ball as it lies. That deal with life as it is rather than as you wish it to be. Confront your challenges and always find a pathway to overcome them. So at 5 years old, sitting in that shack next to a wood-burning heater with smoke curling toward the ceiling from a kerosene lamp, I vowed that I would graduate from high school. At the time, I didn't know anyone that had done it. And so I said I would be the first person I knew to go through 12 years of school. There was no Head Start or kindergarten. So it was just first grade through 12th grade. And that was my goal. And so that made a whole lot of difference in my life.
So you were able to actually overcome all of that and more. What would you say beyond the inspiration of your mother was the reason you were able to accomplish that goal against such odds?
The kindness and generosity of others. Every step along the way throughout my path in life, my path out of the humble beginnings I was born into, I encountered people who were just kind and generous and thoughtful and willing enough to fall into the spell, I guess, of my dreams. I was sort of a shy kid. I eventually grew out of that for sure. But I had no trouble expressing my dreams, the dreams I had for life. And so teachers along the way, like one teacher when I was in the fourth grade, Miss Thompson, on Saturday, she would give up her Saturdays to help take me through advanced math models because she saw in class that I could go faster than the other students in math. And so she didn't want to hold me back, but she said, so on Saturdays, why don't you come to my house and we'll go through advanced math modules. Sixth grade math teacher, Mr. Calvin, first black male teacher I had. I lived life vicariously through imagining the world I could create from math, through the math problems he gave us. I imagine it's simple things like I never went to a restaurant as a kid, but in math I did. I would pretend to go to a restaurant and calculate the tip using math, or pretend to put Christmas lights on our house. What angle would I need the ladder to be to support me and still get to the awning, the peak of the roof to put lights up and things like that. So it was a fascinating world for me, made more fascinating by a lot of teachers or neighbors or this one guy when I was 10 years old that was a World War II veteran, had no legs, but a shoe shine shop. He taught me how to shine shoes. And on Friday evenings and Saturdays, I'd go and shine shoes and earn money that helped us buy food. So just the kindness and generosity of people. Our mother taught us to appreciate even the simplest of things that people do because no one owes you anything, and any act of kindness should be appreciated.
You certainly ended up embodying that through the course of your professional successes. And then, of course, during this journey, which is the stuff of this memoir, Playing from the Rough. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jimmy James. His book is Playing from the Rough, A Personal Journey Through America's 100 Greatest Golf Courses. At the age of 58, you are able to retire after a very successful career with Exxon. And not long after that, you end up undertaking this odyssey to visit and play on the 100 greatest golf courses in the United States. You actually had a couple of different plans before this one actually ended up taking hold. Explain at the outset what you were kind of thinking about doing, and then how things changed and you ended up grasping this opportunity instead.
So the reason I retired at 58 is my career took me all over the world. I would travel maybe close to 200 or so nights a year, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of miles, and that kept me away from home. So I missed a lot of our kids' early years. And so I wanted, before they graduated from high school or during their high school years, I wanted to be home. I wanted to be more part of our kids' lives before they headed off to college. So that led to retirement, a decision to retire early. But I knew that I couldn't go from a globe-trotting businessman running businesses around the world to an idle retirement. So I needed a project. As a young man, before life got very busy and hectic, I would take drives through our country. I would stop in small towns and visit with strangers and talk with strangers and just appreciate who the fabric of who we were, the rich tapestry of who we were as a country. So my goal was to travel to all 50 states in my first year of retirement, play two rounds of golf in each state, one at a private club with friends and one at a public course with strangers. Before I could do that, my wife had gotten me an invitation to Augusta National and a book by this guy, John Sabino, who talked about playing the top 100 courses in the world over his lifetime. So I said, it was all math. I said, I'm going to play 100 courses, so why not just play the 100 best? And so 2 months later, Golf Digest comes out with this 2017-2018 100 Greatest Courses in America, and that became my list, and that became my goal, was to see if I could get on the 86 remaining private courses without ever asking for an invite. 12 of the courses are resort courses. One course is public, Bethpage, Black in New York. And then 87 private courses. I already had an invite to Augusta, so 86 courses that I needed to get onto without asking anyone directly for an invite.
You mentioned this, that this is one of the parameters by which you were going to accomplish this. You were not going to try to pick up the phone and, you know, try to make connections. Maybe a friend of a friend could kind of get you an invitation. You didn't want to be that overt. I think you used the word organic. You wanted these invitations to come to you more organically, more naturally. Why was that so important to you? I'm especially curious because you were making, in a sense, this odyssey more difficult, and it's certainly possible that maybe you wouldn't end up being able to play all 100 of these golf courses, but you were willing to take that chance. Why was that so important to you?
Because I have this belief in the American dream. And throughout my life, in order to overcome the challenges that I've had throughout life, there have always been people who just stepped up and made a difference. So I really wanted to see, with our country sort of the divisions and differences, I wanted to really, I said see, but actually prove that we were still a country where people would voluntarily get sucked into someone else's dream and use their skills, their resources to help that person achieve their dream. So I wanted to see if that could happen still. And I would just talk about what I was doing with everybody I met, and if they were interested and they would help, great. If they weren't, just enjoy their company. And it worked. I mean, it was amazing how when I started talking about the dream and what I wanted to do and become the first person ever to play all of the most exclusive courses in the country in a single year, I could see their mental Rolodexes going off in their head. And people would go, you know, I'm a member here or there, and I'd love to have you come and play my course. Or I know a guy that knows a guy who's friends with this other guy around the corner, and that guy would probably love to play golf with you at his exclusive course. That's how it happened.
I think one thing we have not yet touched on or clarified is your own relationship to the game of golf. And maybe we should even talk just for a moment about just kind of your life as an athlete. I mean, as you were growing up, did you engage in sports to a significant degree? I am guessing, judging from your background, that golf probably did not figure in your childhood at all. But did other sorts of athletic endeavors, were those a part of your life? And at what point did golf become something special to you?
You're absolutely right. Golf was not a part of my life, but I grew up in Texas, so football definitely was. In Texas, if you were a male and didn't play football, it was like you had to go to court and justify it. But I played football and I ran track. Golf, I remember two things from my early years associated with golf. When we moved from the country, from Huntsville, Texas, to closer to Galveston, Texas, this little town, Lamarck, Texas, we were close to a park. And I remember when I was around 10 years old, seeing these guys just hitting golf balls in the park, just hitting balls, not at anything I thought in particular, just hitting, swinging clubs, hitting balls. And I was just curious about it, but didn't know much about it. And then maybe a year or two later, I saw an interview with Jack Nicklaus on maybe NBC or CBS Sports. And he talked about how to hit a ball to a particular spot. And that just fascinated me. First of all, that you could hit this little ball and have it go where you wanted it to go. I just found that fascinating. But I didn't play golf. It was hard. It was expensive, of course. Not something certainly that we had the resources to partake in. I didn't start playing golf until I was 45 years old. I was at a job change. The vice president of my division at ExxonMobil, I was working in Fairfax, Virginia, being reassigned to a position, an executive position down in Beaumont, Texas. And in essence, he said, not his exact words, but in essence, Jimmy, you're going back to Texas. In order to get along with the folks that you will be working with and that will be working for you, you need to start shooting something. So you can shoot animals or you can shoot par. Pick one. My wife was at that dinner, and she picked. She went out and purchased a set of golf clubs for me and a set of lessons. And that's how I got into the game of golf. And the very first time I hit a ball during a lesson, I mean, it was hard just to connect with the ball. But when I hit one, and it was an evening, and that we were under the light in this beautiful star-filled night, and I watched the ball soar above the light into the star-filled sky, and it just gave me this thrill of how that's the easy swing created so much power to launch that ball into the distant sky. And I was hooked. And it's like that first contact, you spend the rest of your golf life trying to recreate that feeling.
We're speaking with Jimmy James about his book, Playing from the Rough, A Personal Journey Through America's 100 Greatest Golf Courses. Jimmy James undertook the odyssey of playing the 100 greatest golf courses in the United States as outlined by Golf Digest magazine, and did so through the course of a calendar year. And his book is a memoir of that memorable experience. As you are talking about your decision to undertake this and kind of the parameters within which you were going to do this, you do mention what you call at one point the elephant in the room, golf's relationship with race. And you go on to say, for the lion's share of its existence in America, golf had been a proud standard bearer for segregation. And of course, I think even people who don't follow the game of golf have some understanding of that. At the outset of your journey, how big a concern was this in terms of how much of that sort of thing, that sort of lingering bigotry, were you going to be encountering during this year?
It was a big concern. Here's a sport that, as you said, it was, as you read from what I wrote in the book, that it was the standard bearer for segregation, segregated communities, segregated clubs, covenants that explicitly excluded people who looked like me. So you're thinking about the idea that I'm going to gain access without asking, gain access to all of these places that used to intentionally prevent or prohibit people who looked like me from playing there. And so I was concerned that there might be people who would think it inappropriate for a black man to become the first person to do this feat in golf, gain access to all of these once prohibited places, and that there would be people who would try to sabotage it so that it wouldn't happen, that I'd feel uncomfortable in all of these places. And so my antennas were up, and the awareness was there and the concern was there. Fortunately for me, I didn't encounter that. I did encounter people that asked about whether I'd experienced those things, but fortunately, I didn't encounter it. And I thought about it quite a bit. One of the things, Greg, in the book that I tried to do, and we've talked about the contrast with my life, the other thing I tried to do in the book is to contrast what golf was like for blacks and this opportunity that I was trying to get of playing all the courses. So I start, the very first course I play is Augusta National. The second course I play is Kinloch, which is in Richmond, Virginia, the shadows of the Confederacy. In between those two courses, I went to a course in Washington, D.C., laid out along the Tidal Basin, East Potomac Park, where there's three courses, and the blue course is a course that has 18 holes, and it was where the National Park Services desegregated golf in this country. The Secretary of Interior did, after four black men showed up one day to play the course and were prohibited, and then came back later and played the course. It was so rich in black golf history that I felt it appropriate to play that course in the middle of this journey, at the beginning of this journey that I was undertaking. And in Playing from the Rough, all of the chapters are named after one of the top 100 courses, with the exception of one, the chapter where I talk about playing at East Potomac. And that is to draw that contrast between the golf world and what it was for so long, and where we're trying to take the golf world now.
One thing that is so interesting is that as you are talking about playing on this historic course, you go on to say that as you went on to play at great courses all over the country, you said, the feeling that I'm somehow trespassing, that I'm still the kid whose first suit was pulled from a town dump and that I shouldn't be let through the front gate, has never completely left me. It's so interesting to read those words because, of course, as we read your book, again and again, what you are telling us are stories and experiences of being welcomed. In most cases, very, very warmly, we hope very, very sincerely. People delighted to have you there. And in particular, I can think of a couple of courses in which there has never been a black member, not because it was prohibited, or at least now is not prohibited, but because a black golfer has never even applied for membership. And but in many of these places, you were warmly welcomed, enthusiastically welcomed. And yet, from the sounds of it, at the back of your mind, there was still this sense, I'm sure rooted in your own background, that made you feel like you were trespassing. Even by the very end of this, was that feeling still there?
So just thinking about for a moment, Greg, my background. Born into the world and identified at the beginning as illegitimate, that I didn't legally exist. In the middle of my journey, I played this course in Texas, Whispering Pines. It's 20 miles from the plantation my ancestors were slaves on. And so this history, and then the time in the sawmill quarters in Huntsville, the whites only signs, those things are a part of who I am and my life and what's made me who I am. And so that thought of that world, even that little 5 and 6 year old I was, this never completely leaves me. But I don't want it to. It actually grounds me and reminds me of who I am, where I came from, and helps me really, truly appreciate this country. And so to me, it's undeniable. Whether our ancestors came to this country freely or in shackles, together we have woven a tapestry of unparalleled opportunity. And so I never forget the humble beginnings. I never forget the opportunities created by all of us in this country. And yes, those demons created with my origin story, they're always lurking. But the great thing, as you said, is I didn't encounter any of that. And it's just this, it's my own demons that I have to deal with, that I'm talking about, that I have to overcome. And I think we're really fortunate to live in a country where the problems we've created for ourselves, there are always pathways, if we have the patience, the perseverance, the determination to find them, there are always pathways to help us overcome our challenges.
Well put. Let me just ask you a couple of quick, very specific golf questions. Again, we're talking about your lovely memoir, Playing from the Rough, A Personal Journey Through America's 100 Greatest Golf Courses. First of all, of those 100 greatest golf courses that you played, were there any where you felt like, why is this on the list? I mean, golf courses that ultimately disappointed you, where you ended up being, in a sense, surprised that they bore that moniker of one of the greatest, or by and large, did you feel like each and every course that you played belonged on that list of the 100 greatest golf courses in our country?
Let me start by saying all 100 of the courses are spectacular courses, but there were some where I was surprised that they were on the list. And there were maybe 5 or 6 or so. And I won't go into naming those 5 or 6, but they all, within the next 2 lists, they were all gone from the list. And there were courses. You know, it's really hard. There are about maybe 20,000 or something courses in the U.S. And you're talking about 100 of them. And so there's some judgment in there, I think. And I think that the top 10 to 15 courses distinguish themselves. There's something unique and special about each of them that no one would argue that they are in the top 10 or 15 or so. Then there's this middle section of courses, you know, the next 50 or 60 courses that are also special, but not as special as those first 10 to 15. And then you get to maybe the last 25. I'd say that the last 25 are probably indistinguishable from the first 25 outside the top 100. Those 50 courses are probably truly indistinguishable, and it's to taste that some ended up in there and some didn't.
What was the hardest course you played? That is, the one in which you found the course itself to be the most challenging.
So there are a lot of hard courses. Pine Valley, which some courses have what people would call let-up holes, where you can relax a little and it's an easy hole and you don't have to think as much about it and you can play the hole well. Pine Valley doesn't even have any let-up shots, let alone let-up holes. Then there's Oakmont, that is just long, challenging, church pew bunkers. There's Shinnecock in the vast expanse on the eastern end of Long Island along the Peconic Bay. And then there's Pikewood National in Morgantown, West Virginia, laid out on a mesa atop limestone deposits with infinity greens that drop into this vast, beautiful valleys around it. That is extremely hard. It is long. It has narrow fairways bordered by 6-inch Kentucky bluegrass rough. The greens, there are no fringes around the green. You miss the green by an inch. You may have trouble finding your ball. It was hard. It took me 105 brutal strokes to get around that course. That's a lot of strokes. And when asked, how did someone that plays golf as much as you do shoot 105? I say, well, I almost shot 104, but I missed a short putt. That's how I got to 105.
As you did this over the course of these 100 golf courses, and of course you undertook this not as a pro or a semi-pro or really not even as someone all that thoroughly experienced in the game of golf. I mean, a relative newcomer to the sport, a sport you loved, but you would never call yourself an expert at it. How important was it how well you did? I mean, as you were on these various golf courses, was it important to you to be playing at as high a level as possible? Or was that largely or at least somewhat irrelevant in terms of what this was all about? Or did that change over the course of this year in terms of how important it was that you play well on these various courses?
So I appreciate your being kind, but I'll say it while you wouldn't. I'm a duffer. I was at 11.5 or so handicapped. My goal was to get down to single digits, down below 10. I got to 9.8 after playing all of these difficult courses. Some courses were just so hard, that I said, I'm just going to enjoy the beauty of being out here and, of course, the people I'm with. But I also set a goal to break 80 on a top 100 course. And fortunately, I broke 80 several times on the courses. So it mattered how well I did just to me, because nobody else cares what you score in golf. They're too worried about their own golf game and score. But it mattered to me. But there were times when the score just didn't matter at all. But times where I really wanted to do well. I was playing at Bandon Dunes, which is a resort out in along the coast of Oregon, has four courses that were in the top 100. And I met this guy. This was early on, you know, the first part of my journey. And we talked about what it would take, what's required to be able to do what I was trying to do. And I said, resources, an understanding spouse, and knowing a lot of people, the ability to meet people. And he said, you forgot one, a lot of humility, because there will be days where you play terribly and embarrass yourself, and you're just going to have to suck it up and take it. And there were those days.
This is probably a harder question, because I'm sure all 100 of these golf courses were beautiful in terms of just visually beautiful, just beautiful to look at, beautiful to walk through. But is there one which had an exceptional beauty that maybe lingers, that sort of haunts you, or maybe a beauty that it was kind of a uncommon sort of beauty?
Well, I'll talk about two. I'll limit it to two. Cypress Point, laid out along the craggy coastline of Southern California with white-capped waves washing ashore, just a long 17-mile drive. It is one of the most beautiful parts of our country that has a lot of beauty. And so that setting, that's absolutely, absolutely beautiful. And then there's a course owned by a single individual with zero members in Marshall, Illinois. That's the southern part of Illinois, called Kenyatta. It took me back to my childhood days. I was the only person on the course. The whole course, they set it up just for me to play it. Only about 100 people a year play the course. And just being the type of beauty it had was not only the physical beauty, but just the ambiance, the symphony of nature sounds all around me and nothing more. Just took me back to the days of being a kid frolicking barefoot through the woods in East Texas. And it just that serenity and that peace and calmness that came over me on that course, just made it a special place for me.
That course again was which one?
Kenyatta, Canyatta.
One of the interesting things about that is that the very next day you end up playing very close to where our radio station is located, to the banks of the Milwaukee River, to the Milwaukee Country Club. And I think what you describe here so effectively is a almost wild juxtaposition, the contrast between what you just experienced in the heart of the cornfields of Illinois to a very different place. You said, I felt as if I'd been beamed into a whole other place, a bygone era of privilege and power. The Milwaukee Country Club exuded all of that. What do you recall about your experience at the Milwaukee Country Club?
So maybe three things I'll talk about. First of all, that clubhouse. That's where I got that sense of, this is a place where the power brokers of this area probably got together and made decisions and things that who did what and controlling other people's lives and all of those things. It just looked like that type of place, you know, just majestic. The wood, the locker room is one of the most distinctive locker rooms of all of the courses that I played. And that against this course that runs along the river in this bucolic setting was in itself, it's a beautiful course. And then that course was actually the most challenging for me to find a pathway to get on, in a sense. It's a small membership, I think, that's mostly local, and it's hard to get onto. And I had a discussion with the head pro while I was at the club, and I said to him, "This club's hard to get onto," and he said, "And we love it that way. I get calls every day, and I give them all the same answer: no." Fortunately for me, in the wheat fields of Kansas, I met a guy who knew a guy whose brother was a member. And that's how I got on to Milwaukee Country Club. Hmm. But the place itself is a place that if I had played it at the very beginning, I really would have been tense the whole time, because it just felt like that sort of place to me, where I would have been uncomfortable early on. But because I'd played so many other places, I was finally getting used to being in that type of environment. Hmm.
And, of course, that's part of the story of this year-long odyssey, isn't it? And, of course, through each of these chapters, you do such a beautiful job, I think, of not only describing the courses themselves, sometimes the country clubs themselves, but also the various people whom you encountered along the way. And woven in are the stories of your own past, your own life's experience. People might be a little surprised to see in the introduction to the book, when you make reference to a very, very famous book by the renowned author Frank McCourt, namely Angela's Ashes. Just say a quick word about the reference you make to this powerful, poignant book and the comparison that you draw between it and your own experience.
So Frank McCourt, and I actually ended up recently meeting someone who knew Frank McCourt and his brother, and told me about that region, Limerick, and in Ireland, and the challenges of life there. And so with that passage, that reflection is thinking about the challenges of life in Ireland that he talks about in Angela's Ashes. The you know, he talks about the priest, the alcoholic priest, the pious defeated mother moaning by the fire. It gives you this sense of the challenges that they face, and so contrasting that, or looking at that with the challenges I faced growing up as a kid in this sawmill quarters, which was a form of indentured servitude almost, in this sort of era where we had whites-only signs. And you look at the Irish talk about all the terrible things the English did to them for like 800 years. And you look at this country where my ancestors were bought over in the bottom of ships, where they had to both eat and defecate, and the challenges of that voyage. But at the end of the day, you look at it, we all have challenges. And to each of us, our own challenge is daunting. So it's not about whose challenge is worse or comparing. It's recognizing that we all have challenges, and to each of us, the challenges are daunting, and our job is to overcome whatever our own challenges are.
Well put.
And so my book, Go ahead.
I just said, well put.
Yeah. So it's about overcoming adversity and challenges. So I talk a lot in the book about the challenges, but every time I talk about challenges, I talk about how either I or others overcame those challenges.
In the end, I think you say this so well, while traveling all those miles and playing all those rounds, shaping all those drives and lipping out all those putts, befriending all those playing partners and heeding all those caddies, jostling through all those airports and eating in all those roadside diners, I reconnected with a country. I found at once beautiful and flawed, big-hearted and wrong-headed, proud and ashamed. Did you emerge from this year-long odyssey feeling better or worse about the country that is your home?
Better. I felt that at the heart, and I'll just give you a story from again, here in Milwaukee, well, not Milwaukee, but Wisconsin. When I was playing Erin Hills, I was paired with these guys, all white guys. They were small business owners. And we were delayed because of a storm. So we sat at breakfast in the restaurant there at the clubhouse at Erin Hills. And we just talked. And so here you had this son of the South with these Midwesterners. And we're having this wonderful conversation about small business. And I mean, these were the men who created jobs for their community. And it's just, there were no differences, sort of. It was as different as we were, the differences melted away. And we were there enjoying breakfast together, interacting and talking. And I saw a similar thing in Indiana one night, just having dinner at a Golden Corral, where I saw every manner of family or person or whatever, and the conversations I was able to filter out were no different than the conversations I heard at these most exclusive clubs. At the end of the day, we care about the people we love, and we want their lives to be better than our own, and we work together to try to bring that about. And so what I like in this book, Greg, what I try to do is write stories to where every reader could connect to something in my life to say, I really understand that. And to me, that's us finding a piece of ourselves in someone else, which helps us understand our shared humanity.
The book, again, is Playing from the Rough, A Personal Journey Through America's 100 Greatest Golf Courses, published by Simon & Schuster, the author Jimmy James. Jimmy James, I am so glad we got to talk about your wonderful book. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate the opportunity, and thanks for reading the book and sharing it with your listeners.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an important conversation that commemorates Gun Violence Awareness Month. We're welcoming back to the program John Tate II, Director of the Department of Community Safety for the City of Racine. Joining him will be Jesse Metoyer, Deputy Chief for the Racine Police Department, and Maurice Horton, Racine County Violence Prevention Manager, talking about efforts underway in Racine to try to curb violence and gun violence in particular. On Thursday, Dr. Brian Mulgart from the History Faculty at Millikan University, he's coming to southeastern Wisconsin to speak to Adventures in Lifelong Learning about his intriguing new book, Wear Some Armor in Your Hair, looking back at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And on Friday, Kaylin Palomares pays her monthly visit to the program with a conversation about the Horlick Dam Project. Our weather forecast is for sunshine this morning, a few clouds rolling in over the afternoon, a high today of 76 degrees. Cloudy and mild overnight with a low of 63. Tomorrow, Wednesday, is going to be sunny and hot. We're warming up to a high of 86 degrees, and Thursday, a high of 89. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News.